This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. This is podcast number 186. And for those of you already looking on YouTube, we have a special guest with us. A young man by the name of Charlie Huggins was with us in February in podcast number 173. And we were inundated with requests to have him back. And he's a big supporter of the show. So we have him back, folks. I'm going to say a big hello to Charlie. Hello, Charlie.
Hi there. All right, Peter. I'm Henry.
Good to see you. And got to say a big hello to my brilliant co-host, Henry Viola here, who's joining us, as always, to bring insights to the podcast. Henry, how are you, sir?
Nice to be with you, Pete.
The delay there, like you're in Australia, mate.
So, who knows? I think the internet's just conked out with the heat. Everything's conked out in London.
Okie dokie. Right, we're going to cut to the chase with this one because Charlie's got so much to share with us. Charlie, we spoke about a couple of stocks last time you were on here. You're a high conviction, high quality sort of investor. You previously, everyone can go back and listen to 173, I think, if they haven't met with Charlie before. You ran money for Hargreaves Lansdown and Wealth Club. And more recently, you're running your own portfolio, managing your own money, and you're running your Substack, which people can find, Charlie Huggins at Substack.com. Okay, so that's a bit of background. But we want to get straight into an introduction, which Henry's going to do, as to why we've had you back, but also the sort of theme of this particular podcast. Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm going to hand over to Henry.
I've no idea what to expect, but go on.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you about SpaceX or anything.
Yeah,
too often.
Oh, good.
Sticking to quality.
So, yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for coming back, Charlie. We just got great feedback last time, and it's really great to have you with us. Last time, for those members of the audience that weren't with us, we spoke quite a lot about your investment philosophy and what you are looking for in a quality business. So I want to dive straight into some companies that we've not heard you talk about a lot before. And in sort of the pre-show chat, we were talking about Compass Group and Next. And I thought that would be a great starting point for tonight's conversation. You know, let's explore what quality actually means in practice, what it's worth, and maybe some less obvious examples of it as well. So if we start off with Compass Group, for those members of the audience that don't know, Compass Group is the world's largest contract catering business. And what interests me about it is that it's an enormous company operating in a pretty unglamorous, fragmented sort of sector. That scale might give it purchasing power. It could give it operational expertise. It could give it the ability to serve large customers. But I'm interested in knowing what you think about it. So why don't we start off with Compass Group?
Sure, yeah. First of all, thanks for having me back on. Very happy to be back. Glad the first one went down okay. Compass, you know, on the surface, you might think this isn't much of a quality business, because if you judge quality by high margins, Compass doesn't particularly have high margins. Its operating margins are there on the screen. What are they?
Actually, have we got them? Let's have a look. Operating margin will be down here.
Operating margin.
Lord.
There we go.
Yeah, 7%.
So just over 7% at the moment. So a lot of people might look at that and say, "Oh, that's normally not a sign of a quality business." And it also operates, as you say, in an unglamorous but also highly competitive sector. So contract catering, what is it? It's serving meals to offices, schools, hospitals, sporting events. We've all probably eaten a Compass meal and probably come away thinking that's not the best meal I've ever eaten, to be brutally honest. It's not gourmet meals, is it? It's not Michelin star. But There are a few things about the business that do make it very high quality. So obviously, it's come through the pandemic. The pandemic is about the worst thing that could happen to a contract caterer, other than poisoning its customers, maybe. It's come through the financial crisis in 08, 09. And both times it's emerged stronger. Many other competitors have fallen by the wayside during that time. So it's a business that has stood the test of time. And the reason for that is twofold, really. Firstly, it's extremely well run operationally. It knows how to serve food to the masses. And that may seem like a relatively easy thing to do, but it really isn't, especially since the pandemic and in recent years with whether it be allergies, food intolerances, making food more digital in terms of how we order food, health and safety regulations, all this co sort of stuff, complexity of catering to lots of different types of customers with different needs. So it's not an easy thing to do. They do it very well. They split themselves into different sectors, which means that they specialize in lots of different areas. They're quite decentralized in that aspect, even though they're a huge business. So they have sub-sector specialisms within the business, which allow them to compete with more special with smaller specialist businesses. But the main thing they have is scale, and in a lot of industries, for a lot of businesses, scale is, if anything, a disadvantage, because scale, I mean, you can see the revenue, what was it, something like 30, 46 billion of turnover. Almost all of that is food catering. So there is some cleaning and services, other services involved in that, but the majority is food catering, food and drink. So that scale, it gives them, as you reference, enormous procurement and purchasing power. It means that they can go to their suppliers and order in larger volumes. It means that they get more dis greater discounts on the food and drink that they buy, and they can share the benefits of that scale with their customers. The scale does not just come from Compass's own operations. So in North America, they have a what's known as a GPO or group purchasing organization called Foodbuy, and that also buys food and drink on behalf of other companies, hotel chains, and restaurants and the like. So by aggregating their own scale with the other scale of all those other businesses, they are by far and away the largest player in this industry. I think they're more than twice the size of their nearest competitors, Sodexo and Aramark. So they have an inherent scale advantage, which they pass on to their customers. They can also take that in higher margins. So they earn higher margins than their customers. They can win more contracts because they can pass on savings. So often, an office or a hospital or a sports event. It's cheaper for them actually to outsource to Compass than it is to do it themselves because they don't have the same scale. So it's a win-win. It's a market that, although it doesn't offer explosive growth, the level of outsourcing, first-time outsourcing, is increasing and is a steady growth driver for the business, because it's much easier for businesses, as I say, to go to a specialist like Compass, and then within that. Compass is also gaining share every year because of its scale and its operational acumen. So it's a business that grows its top line by high single digits and with a bit of margin growth on top. I think this year it's projecting something like 10 or 11% operating profit growth. For a business of Compass's size is very good. If you add on acquisitions, buybacks, things like that, you can get to a low teens EPS growth for Compass, which is very attractive. And it's just a business that personally I would hate to compete with, which is always quite a good sign.
It's a really interesting business, that, Charlie. I used to own Compass Group and rather daftly let it go a lot cheaper than it is now. And it was before I'd really got my head round, I think, analysing underlying businesses. I think One of the things that's attracted me back to it, I don't currently own it, but it keeps piquing my interest. It reminds me slightly of another name I've heard you talk about before, which is Diploma, but also Bunzl. And there's something about these fragmented industries where you've got lots of niche little players that serve a tiny bit of the market and then having a consolidating effect. Is there something in that, for someone like yourself that's looking for quality businesses? Is that a particularly attractive type of industry for you?
Yeah, I think as you say, in this industry, there's a lot of small scale mom and pop, well, how Americans would say mom and pop type operators. It's an industry that attracts small players, maybe even small individual business owners who want to set up food catering and provide food catering. And some of them, or a number of them, do it very well. But as I said, none of them have the scale or the operational expertise. And scale is not just in the procurement, it's also being able to invest in digital, invest in, well, often when Compass wins a contract, it will invest in the premises of the business that it's supporting, in kitchens and kitting out the kitchen or whatever it may be. So there's often quite a large upfront investment, which frankly, a lot of other businesses wouldn't be able to afford and couldn't do. So it's got that advantage versus its bigger competitors, but also the smaller competitors. And as you said, it is a very fragmented market. I like that fragmentation, but I look for certain things. So anyone who's read Nick Sleep's letters would know about scale economy shared. That's what I'm the phrase I'm after. Scale economy shared, which is effectively if you're the big boy in the playground, big bully in the playground, you've got that scale and you can pass it on to your customers. As you said, Diploma, Bunzl to an extent, something like a Costco, and Amazon, even. These sort of businesses that can use their scale and pass some of the benefits on to customers. That's where you start getting a virtuous flywheel because that's very hard to compete with. And that's something that every single year that advantage widens a bit because every year, if Compass outgrows its competitors and it passes the savings on to customers, then it becomes that little bit harder to compete with. So the key is to look for businesses that do genuinely benefit from economies of scale, which a lot of large businesses do benefit from some economies of scale, but they either keep all of it for themselves, so the customer doesn't benefit, or they actually scale benefits are outweighed by diseconomies of scale. So bureaucracy, or just being too complex and having operations in, all over the globe and being very inefficient. Another business, Diageo, we've seen that new CEOs come in and said, "This is so inefficient. This is grossly inefficient. It's so bureaucratic. There's so much cost." So Diageo is a business that should benefit from economies of scale, but hasn't to the extent that it should have because it's had all these other inefficiencies from being such a big business. So being a large business, being the largest player in the industry, doesn't necessarily guarantee the economies of scale. But if you can find it is very powerful.
Brilliant, brilliant response there, Charlie. I wanted to ask you a question about the FX side of it because I noted back in, I'm just going to say the early part of this year, it changed its reporting currency from sterling to US dollars. Now it's an international company, and I think Henry put up where it's most of its revenue was made earlier on. 72% of the revenue comes from the US, so that makes sense. But does it complicate matters because they've got so many different currencies that they're actually dealing with, and now it's just focused on reporting in US dollars? And does that mean that they've got more volatility regarding FX exchange?
I don't think the change of reporting really changes anything other than the presentation. So, to my knowledge, there wasn't really any particular change within the business itself when it changed from sterling to dollars. What it does do is aligns the reporting currency a lot more with the actual currencies that the business trades in. So as you said,
Yep.
over 70% of revenues from the US, and because the US is higher margin, a greater degree of the profits, maybe 75 to 80% of the profits are from the US. So it makes sense. When they were reporting in sterling, they were having to convert those dollars into sterling, and you'd often see big translational FX impacts. So if the dollar was really strong or weak, you could have a big difference between the reported financials and the constant currency financials.
That's a
So
currency.
now there's less of a impact from that. So as long as you price the shares in dollars and you're looking at dollar financials, it's actually probably easier now to understand than it was before. But the key thing to understand is most of its profits are generated in the US. So if you're a sterling-based investor, then if the dollar is very strong or weak, that is going to have an impact on your return. But in the long run, that probably comes out in the wash.
No, I love that reply. I think the other thing you touched on
Oh.
earlier is that they've got such a large base and they're doing so much positive work for customers. So they've actually got a great retention as well that people don't really talk about a lot regarding the customers sticking with them.
Yeah, they do. I mean, most of their contracts are very long in nature. So you're talking about 5, 10, 15, even 20-year contracts. And obviously, at the end of those contracts, the customer will look to renew, well, look to put it up for tender and see whether they want to stick with Compass or to switch to somebody else. More often than not, they do tend to stick. So the switching costs are quite high in terms of you've got the lock-in from the contract, and you've got retention. I think Compass's retention is about 96%. So a lot of the revenues, they're not strictly recurring, but they repeat. They have a mix of different contracts as well. Some of them are tied more to volumes, some of them are fixed price contracts. So they have a few different types of contract, but generally it's a pretty steady business. And even in the, I mean, obviously the pandemic had an awful impact because offices and whatever were closed and no one was eating. But in the financial crisis, I think they saw a relatively modest reduction in revenue and profit, but they bounced back very strongly. So compared to a lot of businesses, I'd say it's quite a defensive business.
Absolutely agree. Henry, over to you, sir. Thank you for
Love
that.
it. Well, I think the other name that you mentioned was Next, which really surprised me. And I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here about retailers, but I'll restrain myself. I'll be well behaved.
Please restrain yourself, mate. It's Leicestershire's finest and UK's finest company, mate.
Well, it's not specifically Next I dislike. It's more the sector. I mean, fashion retail, I think, should be a terrible place to look for a long-term compounder. You've got mercurial, retail tastes. One minute people love shorts, the next minute they're in trousers, then we like collars, then we don't. Colors are in, colors are out. Who knows what's going on? It's intensely competitive. The margins are razor thin. I don't really think it's got much in the way of barriers to entry because, you've got retailers all over the place. And yet, Next is one of those businesses that's really got quite an extraordinary long-term record of bucking the trend on that. Great operational discipline, great capital allocation, increasingly a great online platform from what I've heard. How much of that do you think is unique to Next? And do you think they're genuinely building a bit of a moat for themselves compared to other retailers?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree with all of that. I think what you said is very sensible. I wholeheartedly agree. Retailers, I give a very wide berth to generally. And fashion retail in particular, I give a very wide berth to. And I'd even go as far to say, if you actually walk around a Next store, which I'm sure many of us have, and looked at the clothes, not that I'm in any way, shape, or form a clothing expert, because I am most certainly not. But if you walk around the stores, you come out and you think, nah, just like any other clothing retailer, really. There's nothing particularly distinctive about it. So it's one of those businesses that everything I know about it, I would say just don't go there. And yet, I love it. And sometimes you just have to accept that a business may offer everything that you despise and still be amazing. So what has Next got that other fashion retailers don't have? Well, two words, Simon Wolfson. He's the CEO. He was when he was made CEO 25 years ago, he was one of the youngest CEOs ever. He joined the business in, I think it was 1997 when he was 23. There was family links. I think his father was chair or something. So there was, at the time, it was a bit looked down upon, because, it was all a bit fishy, that he was promoted so quickly, within 10 years. So he started at the very bottom of the business in 97. He's worked his way up. He's become CEO, I think, in 2007. So he's been there 25 years. And when he took over, everyone was a bit skeptical, thinking, he's just been given the job because of his dad or whatever. Very quickly, people realized, this guy's very, very good. And what he's done with the business, don't get me wrong, he inherited a very strong business. What Next had was, when he took over, was the Next Directory, which became the online business. So that provided the foundations for the online business. So Next had a very big start online, which a lot of other retailers didn't. So he was given a good hand. He wasn't inheriting a terrible business by any means, but what he's done with it is truly remarkable. Over that his track record over that 25 years is truly remarkable. And he is an exceptional business brain, a really canny operator. He knows every part of that business inside out, every single detail, even writing some of the code within the business while he's been on airplanes. I mean, these are things that I've heard. I don't know how true they are, but he certainly knows all parts of that business.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
An uncanny ability to see round corners. He saw the financial crisis coming, battened down the hatches before anyone else. He saw supply chain disruption before anyone else during the pandemic. He saw that the future was online and that retail stores were pretty much doomed. And he completely switched the business from being predominantly store-based to being predominantly online. He's got into a number of overseas businesses, which most retailers, when they go overseas, they fail. And Next just reported, I think, something like 35% sales growth overseas. He's been willing to cannibalize his own business. So instead of focusing on Next branded wares, Next now sells, I think, over 1,000 different brands. So I suppose one of the big risks with a fashion retailer is if their own brand goes out of fashion. Something like a Ted Baker or Superdry we saw a few years ago. If any business that's kind of tied to their own brand completely is very subject to fashion changes. But Next have diversified magnificently into they've acquired stakes in some other businesses. They've got wholly owned brands and licenses division, and then they sell third party brands as well. So increasingly, Next is almost a bit like Amazon, but for UK retail, I would say for clothing and homewares predominantly. So it offers that choice. Unlike other businesses, it goes where consumers want it to go. It provides what consumers want. So Diageo didn't do ready to drink because the margins weren't there. Nike was trying to pull out of stores to sell its own products online because that was where higher margins were. Both strategies were catastrophically bad. Next doesn't do that. It says, what do consumers want? And let's give it to them. And it's done that throughout Wolfson's tenure. Incredibly agile. Changes. If it needs to change, it changes. So, as I said, completely wiped out its own profits of, in its retail stores in order to focus more online, and was willing to sacrifice margin on the next branded products in order to sell other people's products, which has been a wonderful decision. Operationally, superb. The business, and if you want to say where is the moat, if there is one, operations. So selling clothing online is incredibly difficult. Amazon hasn't really succeeded in doing that. The reason it's so difficult, one of the big reasons, is dealing with returns. So customers will often order 10 different pairs of trousers or whatever and keep one or two, send the rest back. So what you end up with is all these spare pairs of trousers just stuck in a warehouse somewhere, and then you've got to do something with them and get them back to the right place and somehow still make a margin. It's incredibly difficult. And Next makes margins somewhere in the high teens, operating margin. So yes, Henry, you said retailers, fashion retailers are low margin. Well, Next isn't. Next is a very high margin retailer. So operationally, it does almost everything itself, from its IT to its software to its warehousing to its supply chain to its sourcing to its websites to its customer service operations. It does almost everything itself, and it does it very well. And it does it so well that other brands want to get a piece of the action, and that's why they sign up to what is called Total Platform, which means that Next let the company deal with the brand itself. And the advertising and the selling, and effectively Next handle all the operational gubbins behind it. And it works really well for both parties because they get to leverage Next's Amazon-like operational platform, and they can focus solely on selling their brand. So I'll stop there a minute because that's quite a lot, but I could go on and on. But effectively, Wolfson operational excellence, and a business that is a lot more diverse than it looks, and a business that, as fashion retailers go, is extremely resilient and been able to adapt very, very well.
Charlie, I love what you've just said there because I think that the characteristics of Next has been misinterpreted or not been looked at thoroughly by a lot of investors that just see it as a clothing company. And it, hidden underneath it for a long time has been a technology company. And the fact that you've talked about the Total Platform and the Amazon-esque sort of aspects and segments of the company is music to my ears because so few people talk about that. And you talked about the fact that Lord Wolfson's been in charge now for 25 years. The return over that 25 years is betwixt 5,500% and 5,900%, depending on what sort of measures you want to do. So, I my concern, if I've got any, is that I've all often, and I've said this to Henry before, I've not purchased Next shares because I've been waiting for it to get cheaper. And it never does. It just carries on and carries on and carries on. Because, as you say, they're so resilient and they keep adapting to the changing environment where other companies don't. And if they've got one brand only they're trying to sell and that goes out of vogue, they've had it. So if they're selling 20, 100, 1,000 different brands, you've always got some sort of flow, cash flow going on because only takes one to go wrong, the other 99 can continue strongly. So no, thank you
I
for
mean,
sharing that.
don't get me
Absolutely.
wrong. Don't get me wrong. There's still fashion risk there. There's still
Of course, of
it's still
course.
it's still a business that's going to be impacted by the weather and consumer confidence. And if people, I mean, to be honest, a few years ago, I did think the Next brand had lost its way a bit. Now the other brands did take up a lot of the slack, so it didn't matter that much. But if the Next brand massively fell out of favor, yes, Next would still be okay, but it wouldn't be great. I mean, what you want is both elements of the business working well, the Next brand and the third party brands, and you give consumers that choice, but you hope that sometimes they'll choose the Next brand as well, because the two are slightly, well, they are self-reinforcing. So somebody goes onto the Next website because they want a pair of Nike trainers or something, or whatever, a Nike t-shirt, But then they see something from Next and they think, oh, actually, I'll get that as well, and vice versa.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
the key is obviously get them to the platform and then show them all the choice. The other thing about Wolfson, which I didn't really mention, is capital allocation. So not just operations, but he's probably the best accountant I've ever come across. He runs, although he's the CEO, not the finance director, he's all over the financials, and he understands what creates value and what doesn't. So when he allocates money, spends money, everything has to make a certain margin, everything has to make a return. The returns on capital in the last 5 years are about 30%, which is just staggeringly
Amazing.
high for a business like that. They even build their own warehouses, so you can see their return on capital. Yeah, it certainly hovers around the 30% mark. They build their own warehouses, which very few. So rather than just renting, leasing, paying through the nose, they buy the land, they build the warehouse, and then they either
Build
don't
it.
have the rent to pay, or they sell and lease back and make a killing on it. So just all the fine details are down to a T. The communication, investor communication, is absolutely first
Top
rate.
notch, yeah.
Anyone who's read Next results will know that. Most businesses will tell you what's gone well and won't tell you what's gone wrong. And they'll be over-optimistic with their forecasts. Next are complete opposite. So they've just put out a trading statement a few, maybe last week, whenever. It basically said, yeah, we've done really well, but it's nothing to do with us. It's other external factors. So it won't repeat. You can see there the UK weather, the release of some pent-up demand. We were able to spend a bit more on marketing. They say it every time. There's always a reason why they've performed better, and it's never to do with their own brilliance. But then if they make a mistake, they own up to it. So it's exactly what you want to see. You mentioned the valuation there, Peter. The valuation is actually higher than it has been. It's sort of on a high teens PE now. You can see that it was down around the mid-teens level a few years ago. So the valuation has gone up, and if you're looking for a buying opportunity, you probably wait until there's some big jitters around the UK economy. I'd suggest that I don't think the shares will go up in a straight line, but I think in 10 years' time, you'd be glad to own them.
I think the bit that you said there about not a straight line and there's always something going on. The purchases, a significant proportion of it is online, and therefore the question to you is about potential credit default risk and people not paying for the stuff that they've purchased or taking longer to purchase. And some would say, well, if they're taking longer to purchase, then therefore isn't there an interest on the non-payment? That but I'm on about defaults potentially of people not having their money stumped up.
So they in their online business, they sell either in just in cash or card, obviously. So not on finance, but they also have a finance business, which, as you say, does sell on credit, and it earns an interest on that, on those, that credit book. And obviously that is subject to default, and if the UK economy tanks and people can't afford to pay it, then they'll see defaults. What I would say is that the way they provision for those that risk of default is extremely conservative. So their provisioning is well above the level of defaults that they actually see and has been for a number of years. So during COVID, they basically took loads more provisions, thinking that people would default, and then people didn't because money was thrown around during the pandemic, whatever, for whatever reason, or more people kept their jobs than we expected. But they've only started to edge those provisions down quite slowly. So they're massively over-provisioned, I would say. So
Brilliant.
if that risk did come to pass, I think that wouldn't be a problem for them.
Thank you for that, mate. Henry,
I mean,
over
if you
to
want to
you.
know the big risk is Wolfson. Because
Right. Okay.
everything I've said relies on Wolfson to a large extent. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a phenomenal business there behind the scenes that he's created. and it's not just him
Presumably,
across.
after such a long period of time, though, some of these behaviors are starting to be embedded in the culture of the company. It's not as though he joined last year, and he's fighting a machine that's broken. He's inherited a good business. He's built on it, and presumably a lot of the ideas that he's implemented have got sort of a momentum and a runway to them. So a little bit like Berkshire Hathaway with Warren Buffett stepping back, the whole thing doesn't just fall apart overnight. It hopefully carries on the same trajectory.
Oh yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not going to fall apart. The business will still continue to do well, I'm sure.
But it is a
And
risk.
but it is a risk. I mean, he will. I mean, it's sort of a bit similar with Bernard Arnault at LVMH and these sorts of characters that are very involved in the business. And so Wolfson will be all over the branding, the brand designs, et cetera, et cetera. He'll be pushing his people to take risks and to, if he sees something he doesn't like, he'll let them know. He's got that eye for it, which a lot of people don't. So these things all make a big difference to a business, to the day-to-day running of a business. But if he wasn't involved tomorrow, the warehouses don't go anywhere. The online business doesn't go anywhere. The infrastructure that stands behind it doesn't go anywhere. Where you would worry more would be, will the capital allocation decisions over the next 10 years be as good? And will the operations just start to slip because somebody else is running it who isn't a genius? And worst case, obviously, would be somebody running it who really didn't know what they were doing and destroyed the culture. But even that would probably take a bit of time to happen. It's always a risk, but I do think Wolfson is important to this business. I think he's 58, 59. I think his life is next.
Well,
So I
actually,
don't.
according to ShareScope, I'm getting 60 on here.
60. Well, he might be 60. He might be 60. I thought he was about 59, but he could be 60.
Yeah, either way, he's coming up to a point. He's got some more years in him.
He might have just had his. When's his birth? Oh, did it say his
Doesn't
birthday on
say.
there? No.
Doesn't say.
I mean, he's knocking on. He's either at 60 or knocking on 60. So either way, you could say, will he be there for another 10 years? I could easily see. I could see that
One
he
would hope
will.
so.
One
Yeah,
would
one
hope
would
so.
hope
But
so.
he might not. But even if he steps aside, will he become chairman or will he be involved in some capacity? I would hope so. Because
It would be.
if he
Sorry,
steps away completely,
I was going to say the succession planning will be going on anyway, and he'll be choosing and selecting the individuals who,
oh yeah, I mean, you would hope so.
are practicing exactly how what he's engendered into the company for the last 25 years anyway,
Yeah,
you would have thought.
you would hope so. It's unlikely that he's going to turn around one day and just go, right, I'm off. It'll be very well planned and telegraphed, I would think, a bit like, as you said, with Berkshire Hathaway. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway's is a bit different because, yes, you've got the capital allocation angle. Buffett, well, I mean, from what we've been told, he was still he bought Apple more, not Apple, Alphabet,
Google,
didn't
yeah.
he? Google, yeah. So he's still making a lot of the investment decisions, but Greg Abel is making the more operational decisions. And the private investments. But Berkshire is extremely decentralized. So each one of the businesses that Berkshire Hathaway owns has its own management. So
Yes.
nothing's going to change with any of those businesses. And you could argue that Greg Abel taking over is actually a good thing because it provides a bit more operational rigor, where Buffett would be more inclined just to sit in his office and read annual reports. Greg Abel is out there talking to his business managers, etc. So it's a bit different. Obviously, Next is
More
decentralized to a degree,
operational business,
but
yeah.
it's more of a cohesive operational business. Obviously, it's not involved in anything other than fashion and homewares and beauty a bit. So but I think what you say is right. I think it'd be fine if Wolfson does step aside, but I wouldn't want to see it, put it that way.
Love it. Love it. Thanks, Charlie. Right. I think now's a really good time for Peter to talk on his pet project, actually, because if you didn't know, Pete's been squirreling away behind the scenes at rather an exciting event for the last, gosh, what are we, 8 months, nearly a year. So, Pete, do you want to tell us what is coming up next month?
Well, it's exactly a month away, 18th of September, folks. I've spoken about it a couple of times. I'm not going to go into too much detail of it now because I want to focus on speaking with Charlie. It's the Investor Summit, folks, at the brewery, Chiswell Street, London. At the moment, I think we've gone above 70 speakers and keynote speakers, which are going to encompass stocks, shares, investment trusts, pensions. You name it, we're going to cover the topics, including even angel investing. But we're going to cover some listed companies as well. We've got all the platforms there as well, so you can speak to them directly about, what's been happening with the platforms. I think the main thing for me is the fact that we've managed to get Mel Stride there, the Shadow Chancellor, doing a keynote speak opening for us. And we've got Jeff Prestwich as well, who's going to be looking after the main stage for us. We've got Polar Capital, we've got Lord Adventure, we've got someone from Schroders, we've got everybody there. And Henry and I are going to be there as well, doing a live podcast, not live investor clinic regarding portfolios. So you can bring all your information to us and we'll have a chat. We'll give you some. No advice, obviously, because we can't do that, but we can say what our thoughts would be regarding particular stocks and utilizing the ShareScope award-winning platform. We can have a look at what the stock looks like, good quality, bad quality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've secured a £15 discount for every ticket, and it is just one word, Twin Peaks. So you put that on the second page of your tickets page, you type in one ticket, go to the second page, and then add the discount code Twin Peaks and you get 15%, £15 off, sorry. And within that price of the ticket, you will get your breakfast if you get in there early enough, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. You get your refreshments throughout the day. You'll get lunch, refreshments in the afternoon. You get a meal at lunchtime and something to eat at the end. And also a bar will be open for people to enjoy themselves up until about 9:30, 10 o'clock as well. So that's a full day for what will be around £75 to £90, depending on how you buy your ticket. And if you've got any queries, get in touch with me and let me know. And if you do buy a ticket, let me know on X or on LinkedIn that you're going to be with us on the day of the 18th of September. And if you're going to be coming in to see myself and Henry on the live podcast, let us know. And we'll look forward to seeing you all. Henry, I know you're super excited, mate, because you've been writing about it for a little while now. And everyone's saying, oh, that investor summit that you and Henry have put together. I'm going, Henry's not put together the investor summit. That's why he's got
What
hair.
No, ladies and gents, I have absolutely nothing to do with the Investor Summit other than turning up and looking pretty on a stage for 20 minutes, and I can barely manage that. This is an entirely Peter Higgins and Sam Bell production, supported by some wonderful sponsors. I mean, you've got Jeff Prestridge, not Jeff Prestridge, George Cooper of Equitile, who we had on the show, who's very kindly agreed to sponsor you. I think you've got Polar Capital, Retail Book. And I spotted you've even managed to get a mention in City AM.
Yes, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, City AM are partnered with us now. They've got something like.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code Twin Peaks. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free, and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe today using the Twin Peaks promo code and you can save up to £69. Visit shareScope.co.uk for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
I think it's 4 million a month online subscribers that read the newspaper, and a 68,000 across the city on a daily basis that read the paper. So we're in partnership with them to promote the event. The thing for me now is that having 70 individuals plus that are coming from far and wide across the whole of the ecosystem of the city is a massive, massive achievement. We now need to add to that achievement by making sure that those high caliber individuals have a high caliber audience and a number of audience. So we're aiming for 400. My goal is 500 individuals there and a fantastic networking opportunity for everybody that attends. So we're going to have lots of journos there and lots of people doing vox pops. We've got one chap, Quincy Washington, who's got like a million followers on TikTok and Instagram, etc.
Bigger than us. He's going to be involved with us.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's interviewed lots of politicians as well in the past. So he's going to be involved with us. But the City AM coup was a big one for us to get into the heart of the newspaper that supports the City of London. So we're looking for more substantial names like that before the 18th to back us as well. And we'll see exactly how big we can get it this year. But it's exciting, Henry. It's exciting, but I will not have any hair when people see me next time. It will just be a sheer dome.
Smooth.
I will just say to anyone watching, go and buy a ticket for this, because A, it looks incredible, and B, I know I've seen Peter's events in the past, his hosted events. I've attended one of your events a couple of years ago, I think, and they're always first class. So I would strongly recommend anyone to buy a ticket. And I would be there myself buying a ticket if I didn't have two tiny kids and if I lived closer to London. But I'm hoping that if this event is repeated, then I can get there in the future. But yeah, it looks absolutely fantastic.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Charlie. So yeah, ladies and gents, visit www.investorsummit.co.uk and purchase your tickets for the 18th. We'll look forward to seeing you. Right,
absolutely.
Back to you, Charlie. Sorry, Henry, go on.
No, I was going to say, so back to the show, I suppose. So we've talked about a couple of great businesses here, haven't we? I mean, we've had Compass Group, we've had Next. This sort of triggers me to start talking about something I've been thinking about after the first time you came on the show. It's the difference between a great business and a great investment, because there is a difference between the two. And when I started investing, so sort of 2010, 2012, it seemed to be that people like Terry Smith were going, you know what, just go and buy great quality, buy it, doesn't worry, matter about the price, just buy it, leave it alone, do nothing, get rich, right? Easy money. So loads of people went and bought quality and did nothing. And then the world changed. Interest rates started going up. And because everybody had gone piling into quality and pushed the valuations up so much, they'd become quite demanding. P/E ratios had grown, PEG ratios had grown. And some of those shares that 10 years ago were rated as stock market darlings have sort of fallen off a cliff a bit. How do you distinguish between temporarily unfashionable quality? So something that, you know what, it's got a bit expensive, the market is derated a bit, but it's still a good business. And something where actually the business is genuinely deteriorating.
Well, there's a few things to talk about here. I think let's just assume that you buy a quality business, okay? And you are right. So say Compass Group or a business that has stayed good for a number of years. So not deteriorating in quality. Of course, that could always happen to a business that you have to be aware of it, but let's assume, for the sake of argument, quality business. So what we're talking about here is, can you pay any price for such a business? And the answer to that is clearly no. valuation matters. What we saw when Terry Smith launched his fund, can't remember exactly when it was, but we had a period from maybe 2010, 11 up until about maybe 2021, so a good decade, where quality was massively in favor. And what you saw is businesses like consumer goods, high quality industrials, retailers like Costco, Walmart, got up to really high PEs. So instead of paying 15 times earnings for Spirax Sarco, say, that's a good one to look at. Instead of paying 15 times earnings for a Spirax Sarco, which you would have maybe in 2011, suddenly you're paying 45, 50 times in 2021. You see there. So that's the PE, the top line.
Peaked. Yeah.
Oh yeah, so the chart there. So yeah, you're sort of talking a mid to high PE, mid to high teens around 2012, which is fine. But then you're paying almost 50 times earnings in 2021. And funnily enough, have you got a share price over the last 5 years?
Yes.
So,
It's peaked and come down. Yeah.
yeah,
It follows.
funnily enough, that hasn't worked out too well. You can't pay 45, 50 times earnings for a business that is growing at high single digits and expect to do well. I made a big song and a dance of this on the podcast last time. The value of a business is the discounted sum of its future cash flow. It always has been, it always will be. If you pay too high a price for those future cash flows, then you won't make a decent return. One way to get around that is to basically just do a simple discounted cash flow model and say, okay, what do I think the cash flows could grow over the next 10 years? Apply a terminal discount rate, normally 2.5% or 3%, and choose a discount rate. The discount rate is what return you would hope to earn, whether that be 10%, 9%, 8%, 12%, whatever it is. That spits out a figure and it says, based on those assumptions, this business is worth X. Now, for a if you use an 8% discount rate and you're looking at something like 7-8% profit growth over 10 years, if you're paying beyond about a mid-20s PE, then you're going to, for mid to high 20s PE, depending on the cash conversion and things like this of the business, you're going to struggle to make a decent return. If you're paying high at a teens multiple, then you'll probably do very well, as long as the business continues to grow. So, yeah, I think a lot of people forgot that price valuation matters with these businesses. You can't just buy Unilever on 30 times earnings and expect to do well if the business is growing at mid-single digits. The maths just doesn't add up. So I avoided the Halmers and the Spirax Sarcos like the plague back in 2021. 2020, 21, around then, because the valuations were just crazy. And you look, Unilever's done nothing for 5 years as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a really sound point. And it to me, you're talking about this the right way, and that sounds a little bit obvious because you're the professional here. But it's that focus on the cash flow that I like. What you're trying to do is value how much cash is this thing throwing off? How much is it going to throw off in the future? And trying to assign a value to the business based on that. Whereas I think what quite a lot of investors were naively assuming was that it was that this idea that if this figure, this return on capital employed, was high enough, if this was 20, 30, 40%, didn't really matter what your price to earnings ratio was. You should just pay anything to get it because the strongest companies were the ones with the highest returns on capital. Therefore, buy those and they'll outperform. And that misses the valuation side of the equation.
Yes, completely. And return on capital is that tells you what return the business has made on the historical capital that it's deployed. It doesn't tell you how much capital. So if a business can deploy all of its capital at 19.3% returns, then you're going to do very well. But Unilever can't. It throws off free cash flow like no tomorrow, but it returns it in dividends and buybacks. It's not going out on a acquiring businesses and getting a 19.3% return. It's not deploying all of its cash flow into capital expenditures that will generate it a return. So it can't generate those returns going forward. It may be able to on its existing business, but it can't going forward. So there's always a distinction between what returns has a business made in the past, what returns can it make in the future, and how much capital can it deploy at those returns in the future. There's also another thing that's happened with quality businesses, and it's not just a valuation argument. In many cases, we have seen a deterioration in quality. So look at a Unilever, for example, go back 15, 20 years ago. Its products dominated stores. Online wasn't really a thing 20 years ago. It hadn't taken off in the same way. And you went into a store and you saw Unilever products, Procter & Gamble, and L'Oreal or whatever. There was no room for challengers. There was no real no retailer wanted to fill their shelves with challenger brands because who knows whether they'd sell. They just stuck to the big brands. So all the big brands did was fill the stores with their products, advertise like crazy on TV, and everyone bought it. They could increase the price by a few percent every year. The volumes were increased a few percent every year, and what a lovely business. Whereas what's happened obviously is we've had the internet, which has opened the playing field to lots of smaller brands. Because nowadays you can search the internet far and wide and find all sorts of brands, and you can those smaller brands have more of a platform to access the consumer, such as social media advertising, YouTube, whatever it may be. It's not just all mass market TV advertising, which was dominated by the big companies. So the advertising landscape has fragmented significantly. So the moats of those businesses have weakened significantly. And it's not just consumer goods, it's a lot of consumer businesses. I know, Henry, you're not really a fan of consumer businesses, and I think that loyalty has been tested for a lot of brands over the last 10 years, 10, 15 years, because people have more choice. The internet and Amazon in particular have destroyed the pricing power of a lot of businesses because nowadays you can go on Amazon, search for a product, and see, oh, I can get that 10p cheaper on Amazon than you can in the store or whatever. So that destroys the pricing power of a lot of brands. And obviously with AI as well, more recently, we're seeing a lot of businesses, the moats are being questioned around AI, whether they're sustainable, whether AI will erode those barriers to entry, lead to more competition. So when even if you're investing in a quality business and you think the business can grow by X amount over 10 years or whatever, you've got to be have a margin of safety because you don't know what's going to happen. And a quality business can become slightly less quality. And instead of growing at 10% a year, it's growing at 5% a year. And suddenly the valuation is a lot lower, is the justified valuation is a lot lower than what you might have paid. So you need to, you need a margin of safety. And I think everyone forgot that during the boom, quality boom period. What we're seeing now, of course, is that quality is really out of favor. And suddenly you can buy Diageo on 13 times earnings, and you can buy a lot of these phenomenal data businesses on teens multiples instead of 30 times earnings. So we've seen it completely turn, and everyone's given up on quality. But now is the time to really get be interested in quality businesses because the valuations are
More
actually give you
reasonable.
they give you a much more margin of safety now, whereas before they didn't.
I agree 100%. And I think, a moment ago I'd got the Unilever income graph up, and you can see it's more or less flat over 15 years. They haven't actually grown their turnover at all. They were growing their profit margin for a while, and then that stalled as well, because actually there's only so much margin you can squeeze out of these products. And I think the other thing that you picked up on AI. It used to be that people would optimize web for search engines. So how do you appear at the top of Google? You could often pay to appear at the top of Google if you wanted to. You can't pay to appear at the top of ChatGPT. Now, maybe that's going to change over the next 10 years, but if you ask ChatGPT right now, oh, I don't know, my wife says I smell, what soap should I use? Is it going to recommend a Unilever brand, or is it, who knows what
Oh
it's going
yeah,
to?
it's all changing, and I think businesses, I have noticed that Google advertising is I think businesses are actually having to lean more towards paid advertising on Google rather than natural search. Natural search is free, whereas I think maybe this is with the AI search algorithms that have come in or whatever, that businesses are having to do more paid advertising. That's eating into their margins. If you're reliant on traffic from a third-party source, then you're always a bit vulnerable. It makes me very nervous, these businesses that are totally dependent or very highly dependent on Google for traffic. It does make me nervous. I know a lot of businesses are nowadays, but it does make me nervous because I don't think you're completely in charge of your own destiny then.
You're
And
definitely not.
as you say, who knows how AI will change things. But you going back to Unilever, I mean, it's a business that basically doesn't really grow. I mean, actually, its last trading statement was better. It showed more volume growth, I think. But when you incorporate the FX headwinds, because a lot of its sales and profits are in emerging markets, and then of course the currencies weaken, so you might think you're growing by X amount, but then you convert it back to sterling, and you're not really growing very much at all. So even if you look at their results, if you compare the constant currency figures with the so look at underlying operating profit up 0.9%.
Whoa, fuck.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really very exciting, is it? So yes, they've grown their sales by 4.8, and the underlying operating margin is apparently higher, but the underlying operating profit is only 0.9% higher, and a big reason for that is currency.
Yep. Spot on. Spot on.
Yeah, brilliant analysis there, Charlie.
Right. Well, I can see we are rapidly galloping towards 8 o'clock, and Peter has threatened to shoot me if we overrun this evening. So I've got one final question for you, Charlie. In fact, I've got two, if I'm allowed two. Just to put you on the spot as a bit of a curveball. So we've talked a lot about companies you like. What's one company that you currently really like, but you wouldn't buy at today's price?
Probably I'd love to own Costco, I think. It's not a UK business, but it's obviously US listed retailer. It has maybe about 20 stores, don't quote me on that, in the UK, something of that order. It's a really, really well-run retailer. It's what we were talking about before, a bit with Compass. It's a scale economy share, so they don't try and increase their margins every year, their gross margins. They hold them flat, and they pass all the savings on to their customers in lower prices. They have a much lower range of SKUs than other retailers, than other food retailers. They sell in bulk. They sell off pallets rather than shelves. So that why is that important? The whole business is set up to minimize cost and to maximize the benefits of scale. And every year they pass those cost savings onto the customer. So it's a really, really well-run business that is run entirely, largely for the customer, that also makes very healthy returns. It's obviously a membership model, so it makes money off the food and drink and fuel that it sells, but a lot of the income it makes is membership income. So people pay an annual fee to shop there, and you've got to be certain professions. I mean, it's quite a wide range of professions, but it sort of creates this thing of you're part of a club, and it's a bit like Amazon Prime. Once you start paying the annual fee, then you're more likely to shop there, obviously, because you want to maximize the savings that you're making. In terms of price of the products, is very good for the quality. I think I personally love Costco as a business, as a shop, as a consumer. I think the stuff that they sell is really good quality. Just to give you an example, I moved into a new house a few years ago, and I think the previous owners had got like Amazon Basics taps or something, and they'd broken and they were leaking. And I thought, I can't have this. Yeah, I just want good taps. I don't want to pay through the nose for them, but I want good quality taps that are going to last, and that I'm not going to have the plumber around every couple of years. So I just went to Costco and bought some. And the reason I did that is because I know their reputation for quality is that they'll be good taps. I didn't do any other research other than that. So if you can build that trust with your consumers to say, we sell good quality, a bit like John Lewis, never be knowingly undersold or whatever, then it's a huge advantage. I just think it's a really good business. But why
I
don't I
love
own
it.
it? I think The valuation is too high.
The
It's been too
valuation's
high.
eye-watering. I mean, the
Eye-watering.
we're up here in the 50. We're over 50. It's on a PE of 52.8 at the moment.
Yeah, so it's probably, it's growing. It grows well every year. So the valuation does come down next year. Or for 2026, say it's on 40 something PE, but it's still a very high rating. What's the forecast?
46, 42, and 38 by
So
28.
the EPS is growing at low teens, say double 10 to 13% a year, which is great for a mature retailer, but you don't want to be paying 40, 50 times earnings. If I could pay 25, 30 times, that's probably
You'd
okay.
be in there. You'd be in there.
I think so, around that level, probably.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Can I just ask a quick question about your selection of stocks, please, Charlie? Because there's a stock I want to talk about, and I know it's very rare that I've seen you talk about anything related to AIM because you don't go that far down the rabbit hole regarding quality. But I want to talk about this particular stock and ask you a question about it because of what's happened in the past X amount of months. And this is related to EasyJet and the multiple takeover bids that it actually had. I think it ended up with six bids in the end, and it's gone with Apollo now versus Castlelake, who made five bids. And the bid's gone from sub £4, sorry, from sub £4 to £7.15, and Apollo have won it. But the company I want to talk about in relation to EasyJet is Jet2, which is a 2.9 billion market cap company, which I think has some of the quality metrics. It's done reasonably well in the past 6 months, despite all the flux and the noise around, oil, Brent, and all the rest of it, and what could happen to the jet fuel that they actually need to utilize to fly their planes. Obviously, they purchased their oil well in advance and hedging all the rest of it. But I want to have your thoughts about, obviously, it's a retailer as such, selling holidays and all the rest of it. But it appears to me to be a quality company which doesn't get the attention it deserves. It sits in at a market cap of 2.9 billion. EasyJet's just been taken out for, I think, 5.5 or something, or close to that amount. Is there a possibility that Castlelake or somebody else comes for Jet2, having failed to get EasyJet? And obviously, do you think it's a quality company as well?
Yeah, that is interesting. I'm sure the other bidders for EasyJet, I'm sure all of the bidders probably did their homework and looked at the other UK airlines. So yeah, I think it's a good point. They potentially may. It's always the amount of work often that goes into these takeovers is quite extraordinary. I mean, maybe less so with people that are joining late in the game and bidding, but generally, there's a lot of work involved in taking over a company and doing the level of due diligence that you would want to do before making that decision. So, why is that important? Well, it does sometimes mean that they don't want to walk away so easily, or if they do walk away, they might have another target in mind. And as part of the analysis to buy EasyJet, I'm sure they looked at others in the sector. I mean, obviously, I've no idea whether Jet2 would be the next one, but I wouldn't be entirely surprised. I think it's a well-run airline and package holiday operator. I've had package holidays with them in the past that have been very good. I mean, it kind of does what it says on the tin. It's good value for what it is. I think they're customer focused. I think from what I know of them, they have a decent culture. I think they've got integrity, all of those things, so I wouldn't worry about anything like that. I mean, but obviously it is in a very difficult sector. So I don't think it's one that I would naturally gravitate towards. But if you're looking at owning a business in this sector, then yeah, you could probably do a lot worse than that.
Thank you very much. I think I'll have to quote Warren Buffett here because, we were mentioning him throughout this pod, and he famously called the airline industry a death trap for investors and a bottomless pit. But yet you've got Apollo spending 5.7 billion to buy EasyJet. So somebody thinks there's an
Oh.
opportunity there
And the other thing,
going forward.
Peter, is Buffett went against what he said and bought into airlines himself.
I was just
So
about to say
he
that. Absolutely. And he did the same
he
with
said
Apple. Did the
he
same with
said
Apple as
yeah, he
well.
did the same with Apple. He did the same with railroads. If you go back far enough, he said,
Yeah.
these are terrible things, and then bought them. I think with
Talks down the
railroads,
price and then buys them. Yeah. Good
yeah,
old
I think with
Buffett.
railroads, he actually was right that the industry structure had changed. I'm not sure so much with airlines. I think he bought them, and then I think the pandemic happened, and then he just said, well, things have changed, and I'm going to get out. And that's actually a great lesson in being able to say something
Change
and then totally go against your own word and do
your
something
mind.
completely different.
I
That's
think
the that's
that's one of the lessons investors as investors we have to learn. And Henry and I talk about this repeatedly on the pod, where we feel like we've been stung almost regarding a stock, and we go, "I'm never going to go there again," because we've lost some money, or we mistimed the purchase, or there's been a big profit warning, and we exit, and then we watch the prices go up and up and up, and we're going, "No, I'm not going to go there," and it keeps going up. So you've got to be have the psychological awareness to transition from hate to let's have a look at it with a fresh set of eyes,
Yeah,
look at the industry or
you
any
do.
individual stock.
You do need to do that. You also need to know. I mean, if the reason you got out of a business is, it doesn't have the moat that I thought that it did, or I don't trust management anymore, or whatever, then the fact the share price goes up afterwards, it doesn't matter because that's the conviction isn't going to be there. If it then sells off again, those same issues are going to come to the surface, and you're going to think, oh. So it all depends on what the reasons are for getting out or for getting in the first place. But if something changes with the business or the industry structure or whatever, then yeah, look at it again, definitely.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that, Charlie. And read to you, sir. I think that was it from me, other than to say a huge thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed that.
You take the share screen off for us, please, Henry,
I was
whilst
going
we're
to say
doing
I
our
can.
closures? Thank you very much, mate.
The yeah, just another fantastic episode, Charlie. And could you remind us before we go? We've heard about the Investor Summit, but could we remind the audience where to find your fantastic blog?
Yes, so I have a Substack, which is hopefully there'll be a link or something. I can never quite remember the address,
I've
embarrassingly,
got it
but
here.
I think
I've got it here, Charlie. I will do you the honor. It's
It is.
charliehuggins.substack.com, the fiercely independent investor.
It's called the Fiercely Independent Investor, mainly because I couldn't think of another name.
I love it.
So it seemed like a good as any, but also I do try to be independent minded and to come up with my own view of things in every walk of life, try to be independent. So if you go to my blog, you're not going to find hopefully the same opinions that everyone else are trotting out. You won't find really popular companies always being discussed. What I try to do is just talk about some of the businesses I've discussed today, why they're interesting. Sometimes also talk about businesses I'm avoiding. It leans more towards UK businesses, but it does have a smattering of global names that interest me as well. I try to keep it conversational and easy to read and informal, and so you don't feel like you're reading, well, AI. Which I don't use, well, I for research, but never for writing. And that you don't think you're just reading some analyst note or something that stretches for 50 pages and is laden with corporate gobbledygook. So I try to just give you things in layman's terms, businesses that interest me. There's a mixture of free content and paid content. So yeah, feel free to check it out. Yeah, feel free to get in touch as well if there's anything that you want to discuss with me.
Brilliant. Ladies and gents, that was Charlie Huggins, who's been absolutely fantastic once more. You can find him on X at Charlie Huggins underscore. And you can also find him on LinkedIn, where he shares some of his additional information as well. That's a wrap, I think. Henry, a big thank you to Absolutely. you, Charlie, for being absolutely fantastic again. We'll carry on chatting once we've shut this down in a minute. But last words to you, Henry. Thank you for being a brilliant host as usual. Thank you very much. Just thank you to everybody that's tuned in. If you've not got your tickets for Investor Summit, please get online. It's Investor Summit 2026. Get your tickets. Use the Twin Peaks code to get your £15 off. If you don't know what Pete and I are doing, get on LinkedIn We've got a small campaign running, so you can find out more about the episode we're doing. Go follow Charlie on his Substack, and remember to like, comment, and subscribe on the show wherever you listen or watch.
Absolutely. We want to hear your feedback regarding Charlie's pod. He was brilliant last time. And because of you, ladies and gents, we had him back. And we're quite happy to have him back. Come Christmas again if we need to. If Charlie's up to it, he
It's
might
always
be
a,
twice as
no,
enough.
it's always a pleasure to be on this podcast. Really, really enjoyed it. Fantastic hosts, great questions. Just keep on doing what you're doing. Thanks for everything you've done to support me as well. Thank you very much for having me back on. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your continued support, Charlie. We appreciate it very much indeed. All right. Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. Take care, show love, show kindness, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks' time. Over and out.
Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.